Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols. Today, we're looking at winners and losers so far in this pandemic era, and as we look forward to a post-pandemic world. With three of our regular and most prolific contributors, Ron Shevlin, Director of Research for Cornerstone Advisors and Senior Contributor to Forbes, Penny Crossman, Executive Editor, Technology at American Banker, and Jim Marus, Publisher of the Digital Banking Report and Co-Publisher of the Financial Brand. The impact of the COVID-19 novel coronavirus has been both global and catastrophic, as both a public health crisis and as a worldwide economic crisis. And we're still in the relatively early stages of it as we record this in early May of 2020. The financial services industry is caught in the squeeze, as many workers are at risk on the front lines, providing much-needed access to relief loans, while others are adapting to social distancing directives. Dealing with the health risks will continue for a while, but what's likely to last even longer are the economic effects, and those have always had a big impact on the financial services industry. So let's start with where we are today, roughly 2 months into dealing with some of these issues. Who are the winners and losers so far? Is it the big banks, the community banks, credit unions, direct-to-consumer fintechs, those fintechs working with traditional providers? Penny, let's start with you. What are you seeing so far?
Thanks for having me, JP. It's fun to be here. So, in the bigger picture, everybody's losing, right? Because everybody is struggling. Their customers are struggling. Their employees are struggling. Their balance sheets are struggling. I think in terms of companies that are actually kind of benefiting from this whole crisis, you might put some of the payment companies in that group, like Stripe and Square and possibly PayPal.
Even the card companies, right? Visa, MasterCard, Amex, all had pretty decent earnings and mostly increases in revenue.
Yeah, I think Amex had a 75% decrease in revenue. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but I think some of them are doing well because there's more online spending. But because there's no travel, I think there's also a lot of struggle there as well. So I think some of the banks are doing as well as can be expected financially. There's so many different ways to look at winners and losers. Is it financial? Is it reputational? Are they gaining some traction, some new customers through this crisis? Obviously the big banks have attracted a lot of new customers, I think partly because of the convenience that they provide over their mobile banking, as most bank branches are either closed or they're only available by appointment or through drive-through. So people are forced into digital channels, which the digital movement gives big banks an advantage because they do have apps that generally are fuller featured and have really good uptime. In terms of the small business relief program particularly, and we're probably going to get deep in the weeds on that, but
we are.
So there are banks that did get a lot of loans through quickly, especially in the first round, and then in the second round, some of the fintech lenders were able to squeeze in there, even though they were late to get their approval. So we can go deeper into that. But overall, I don't think anybody's doing fantastic in these times. Another thing I would say is collections technology companies are doing a little bit better. Like TrueAccord is having a good run, because more people see the need for a better approach to collections.
Well, and probably more of that coming. So yeah, you've offered a lot of categories for us to think about and explore today. Jim, what's your perspective?
Well, I think, it goes without saying that those companies that were furthest advanced in their digital transformation had the least pain, be it as far as account opening post March 1st, let's pick a date. They were the most well-positioned for the SBA loans. Because honestly, if you're processing with paper in the way that the government dropped this on your desk, it was not the best scenario. And I think those organizations that are providing digital services to financial institutions or had projects in process, I had a call with the Verizon sales team for the financial services industry, and they all but said, we're going nuts right now in business. It's overwhelmingly good. But most of it was people that already had said, yeah, we buy into your concept. We buy into everything that's going on. We're just not ready to pull the trigger, which is the whole scenario pre-March 1st where the doctor said, you know, you got to lose weight. And you go, okay, I will. And then you go to the doctor and he says, oh, by the way, you're about to die and you can't get on a treadmill fast enough. I think those organizations that had projects in process were in a great position. I think a lot of organizations are still trying to figure out what they're going to do. Some organizations are quickly transforming themselves almost on a dime. I thought it was extraordinarily surprising to a degree that TD Bank announced, I think a couple of weeks ago, their entire call center was going to be given the opportunity to stay remote. That shows an organization that was already positioned to do things digitally in the truest sense of the word, because you know, you're able to monitor, you're able to measure, you're able to look at call center. The whole technology behind call centers is being able to distribute calls and monitor how well they go. To be able to do that remotely, it's kudos to TD for that, in much the same way that I think, you know, Bank of America, with their advancements in digital transformation overall, really benefited. They benefited from account openings. They benefited overwhelmingly on new savings accounts opened, which we're seeing. That's one of those surprising dynamics that's happened because of the COVID crisis, that people are opening brand new savings accounts. That's not because they're taking money out of the investment services world. It's because people are saying, I need those envelopes set aside for these unforeseen circumstances that only as late as, you know, mid-February, I thought we were so far away from that kind of scenario.
Yeah. Well, you've also brought up a couple of things I think we're going to drill down on for sure. And Ron, I saved you for last just so you can argue with something that Jim or Penny said.
I hate to disappoint everybody, but I'm not sure I do disagree. But I do want to preface my comments by saying, you know, I think like what Penny was saying is too, winners and losers feels a little tough to kind of call here. I would tend to think of what I'm kind of thinking here as more like bumps and dents, you know, those that got bumped up a little bit and those that got knocked down a little bit, not necessarily winners and losers.
But come on, you're better at writing clickbait than that.
Yeah. Well, you know, when there's page views to be had, then absolutely I'll go for it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. Let's go with the bump and dent sale.
Okay.
For now.
So both a bump and a dent goes to Bank of America. Bank of America did the $43 billion in PPP loans, which gained them about $1 billion in fees. You can knock them all you want, but that's pretty good amount of money. The dent, however, is that they were in the forefront of being accused of basically front-running their larger loans versus the smaller ones. And I think the longer-term implication of that is, because I think other larger banks did the same thing. You know, I just did a study, found that more than 50% of small businesses, those between 100,000 in revenue and 50 million in revenue, more than half consider one of the large or regional banks their primary bank. And I know it's not easy to switch banks, but I think this is the kind of situation that's going to make a lot of small businesses rethink that. You know, Brett, he was one of the first to kind of publicize the whole issue with Bank of America. So both a bump and a dent goes to Bank of America and to some of the large banks in particular. A bump, definitely, and a bigger bump to the community banks, who I think, you know, I call this the revenge of the community bank nerds. You know, for a long time, they've really been knocked on as being losers in the market. They've really ceded the retail market to a large extent to both the large banks and credit unions over the past couple of years as they've kind of doubled down on commercial lending. But, you know, here's the irony of the situation. Who's been the winners in the financial services space and specifically the banking space over the past couple of years? Are those firms that have gotten out there with technology that adds to convenience, that have made their customers' lives more convenient? Well, you know, the community banks have kind of trailed, and they have not been particularly better at the automation piece with the PPP loans. But because they burned the midnight oil and really went to bat for their customer base to get these loans in there, you know, the press is covering that. They're getting there. It's a definite bump up for the community banks. A potential dent could go to them because I got to tell you, nobody wants to tell you this, but there were plenty of smaller banks, smaller community banks, who also prioritized the larger loans over the smaller ones but that just doesn't get the kind of press that you're going to get when you're a JP Morgan Chase or Bank of America. While I agree with you guys about the benefits to some of the fintech providers, I think there's a dent that goes to some of the neobank challenger banks who have found that because they have not sort of evolved into the lending space just yet and have relied very heavily on interchange and the payments, you know, I think they're going to find themselves struggling in the short term for this. And especially since they've, you know, struggled to kind of become the primary providers to a large extent of their customer base. You know, some of them, like Chime in particular, did gain some good publicity at the beginning when it sort of advanced some of their customer base, the stimulus checks that were sent out. But, you know, that only went to a relatively small percentage of their customer base. So great PR, but not huge impact. And I think that longer term, they're going to struggle to have to kind of come back to kind of gain their mojo coming out of this.
Yeah, well, I'm trying my best to stir a fight, and I've been unsuccessful so far, and I don't think this one's going to work either, because, Jim, that sounds like an awful lot of things you've been talking about a lot in terms of certainly personalization and understanding the customer. Do you think Ron's right? Is this revenge of the community banks? Are they winners in this?
That may stir a fight. To a degree, yes. I think they're more connected to the community, but I don't see their true personalization being that much better. I deal with the top six bank, which almost anybody who follows me knows exactly who they are. And my first communication, and actually only communication about PPP loans, was something that came out and said, as a small business customer, there are opportunities available for you in this Small Business Association PPP loans. If you currently are an online banking customer, connect with us through that app. And if you're not, sign up for online banking today. Well, they had me until they said, if you're not an online bank customer, if they don't know that already, and if they can't personalize to that level, that's a big bad mark. And add to that the fact that they have not reached out once about, hey, how you doing? And yet for the 2 months prior to COVID, they're reaching out monthly about trying to get my retirement funds transferred to the bank. Now, I will say that one of our joint friends, all of our friends in the community banking market out of Oklahoma, they've reached out to me 3 times to try to help me. And they're not my local bank by any means. This is where we may not close our accounts today, but as people remember, we remember who's there when we're up against the wall. And small businesses aren't out of the woods at all yet. All PPP loans did was pay for payroll. It doesn't pay for keeping me in business. And I think we're all going to have to look and say, who's got my back when things are tough? By the way, you may not be able to give me a loan. You may be like Chase and Wells Fargo, who say, we're not going to be doing home equity lines of credit. We're not going to be doing small business loans because of the risk involved right now. That may even be okay if you at least reach out and show some empathy. Now, that said, smaller organizations, smaller banks, tend to do that better than the biggest banks, even though on a number of customers per calling officer, it comes out probably about even. I think we're really going to see who's in the position to make me a consumer or me a small business owner feel like you're on my side. And I mentioned PayPal quite often. They've come out to me more than once and said, if you need a line of credit to get you over this hump, let us know. They're not talking about the SBA loans. They're talking about just knowing my business and knowing that the risk is not that great. My traditional bank doesn't do that. So the whole personalization, the importance of data overall, is going to prove to be much more important than the ability to handle digital transactions. I think at the end of the day, if you're not applying data and advanced analytics to know me, look out for me, and reward me, you will fail in the environment in the economy going forward. And we're nowhere near out of the woods. As we said in previous conversations together, the health crisis is only the tip of the iceberg. The economic issues are going to be longer lasting, and how organizations who are going to be under financial stress as well, how they react to that is going to make a big difference.
Oh, for sure. And a lot more to unpack there. Penny, you've been reporting a lot on this too, and the banks are always lightning rods for litigation. You hinted at this. This is no exception. We're already seeing lawsuits, as we already talked about how banks prioritize accepting and processing the applications. I mean, this only gets worse from here, right?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure there will be more. I mean, the second round is not quite over yet, and the second round of the PPP relief loan lending looks a lot better than the first one. The first round, there were about 1.7 million loans made, and the average loan size was 206,000. That's pretty big. You're not really reaching the smallest. There were some small businesses that did get loans, but for the most part, it was those very large loans that Ron mentioned before. The largest businesses seemed to be prioritized by most of the banks because the fees were, they could get higher fees. Also, some of those larger customers were existing lending customers. So they had already run through the gamut of credit underwriting. And so they were sort of a known quantity, easier to make a loan to than some kind of new business that the bank hadn't ever vetted or done due diligence on before. But the loans are smaller in this round, so it is looking a little bit better. But I also think you have to look to the government for some of the things that went wrong, because the rules around the size of business were not there. I mean, there wasn't a requirement that you had to lend to make a certain amount of loans to companies below a certain size. So, you know, without that directive, there was no real reason for the banks to prioritize their smaller businesses over the large ones. You know, and large businesses do have people that they employ that they want to keep paying. So it's not like they're not legitimate recipients. It's just that the small businesses were pretty overlooked in the first round. And I think I've lost track of what you actually were asking me. Sorry.
Well, there's so much. I mean, we could probably do the whole show just on the PPP program. And I do want to stick with it just a little while longer, because I want to talk about the forgiveness process. We were talking about the lawsuits that have already been generated. I suspect that we'll continue to have a lot more. You know, economists at the Federal Reserve in New York looked at some of the SBA data, and they saw that the PPP loans weren't correlated with prevalence of infections or even to unemployment claims as they looked at it on a state-by-state basis. The strongest correlation was with states with more community banks and those in areas with pre-existing banking relationships, which is what you were just talking about. And you know, so far through this, the smaller institutions have done most of the lending. Only about 26% of the market share was from the 15 largest banks. And that's not the trend we've been tracking for the last several decades. So we'll talk a little bit later as we think about which of these new trends are really new and will stick around versus the ones that are maybe a little more ephemeral. But Ron, you've written about this too. What do you think about how the loans have been distributed?
You know, don't want to go back to your point, though, about the correlation to the states and to the businesses. You know, this is where people just love to throw out statistics without really defining what they are.
And correlation, you know, is causation. I don't care what you say.
Absolutely. If it suits my needs, then absolutely. But, you know, they love to throw numbers out like there's 30 million small businesses out there. But reality is that 80% of them don't have employees. This was the Paycheck Protection Program. If you did not have a paycheck. Now, they still included 1099 and gig workers to a certain extent in this, and they could apply for those things. But, you know, here's where you get back to who's going to do this and act faster. It's probably the $50 million small business with a, you know, at least small but competent accounting team who's going to jump on this much quicker than the three-person small business who's, you know, trying to plug in numbers in QuickBooks every night or something like that. And so, or waiting for their payroll provider, if they even have one, to provide them information. So, you know, and to your point, Penny, and I don't ever want to seem to be in a position of defending the government. That I never find myself in that position. But, you know, to a certain extent, two things. Number one, we should never expect the government to get it right. I don't care what the situation is, whether it's this or anything, there's always unintended consequences that the government never manages to take into account when it enacts regulations. But second, and more importantly, I think here is, you know, they were a bit under the gun. If they had waited even another 24, 48 hours to review these things and get the T's crossed and the I's dotted, they would have taken even more heat for not getting the program in place. So they were a bit of a, you know, rock and a hard place on this one.
Thank you, Ron Swanson, Shevlin.
Yeah.
I think, though, playing into that is just that the banks are always going to be the scapegoats. The banks have not been shy about claiming victory, that all this money went through banks, and particularly small banks. And we talked about some of the structural reasons why that was true. And the government also not shy about claiming victory about how many dollars have been out, how many loans, how many people have been impacted. But at the end of the day, anything that goes wrong in the public perception is going to be it was the bank's fault. Yes, the rules were confusing and last minute and conflicting in many cases. And there's a whole other can of worms yet that we haven't even begun to open, and that's the forgiveness process. There was a pretty good article in the New York Times recently, and they talked about so many of these borrowers from their perspective. They focused on the forgivable part and this idea that they will very easily turn it a loan into a forgivable grant. But of course, there's some criteria around that, which were also fuzzy and being clarified as we go along. And that was, you know, Penny, kind of my original point when I said this is just the beginning, because we can complain about how we originated the loans, and we're going to have a whole lot more to complain about when we talk about which loans are forgiven.
Well, yeah, I think the burden will be on the small businesses to prove that a very high percentage of the money that they got was actually put into payroll. And a lot of businesses are struggling with that. I think a lot of them have furloughed people. A lot of them are simply not operating, so they just can't afford to keep paying people who aren't really working. So it does seem like it's going to be very challenging for a lot of these businesses to get that forgiveness, even though that was the goal. And that's what will make, you know, this felt like kind of a dream for the banks, that they make these loans that are backed by the government, and they get to reap the fees with what felt like little risk. But I think if a lot of these forgiveness goals are not met, if the requirements are not met, these will become regular loans, is my understanding. And then the banks will have to actually service them and deal with delinquencies, defaults, the way they normally would.
So question, Penny, I'm not familiar with the loans completely, but does a small business then have to prove it through the bank or directly to the government? Where's the flow of communication go?
JP, can I address? It's to the bank, guys. They report back to the banks. And it's funny, JP, that you mentioned an article in the New York Times when you could have mentioned my article in Forbes.
Well, Ron, how many people have seen that article? I'm just wondering. Three, four?
So as of today, that article has generated over 320,000 page views. And that is, I mean, orders of magnitude better than anything I've ever seen. So
well, flog it away, Ron.
So absolutely. So here's the thing, and I, you know, I titled the article the coming PPP forgiveness nightmare, because, you know, on the face of it, you would think that the calculating the forgiveness amount would be very straightforward. The AICPA actually came out with a, you know, very nice PDF, simple five-step thing, but when you start looking at the details, you know what, it's not that simple. And, you know, it's funny, thanks to this article, I'm getting a lot of messages through LinkedIn from people, small business owners who've read this, and they're really worried that this is going to turn out to be a whole lot more complicated. And part of what I was writing about is that the banks really need to get on the stick here, proactively communicating, here's how what you have to do to track this stuff, here's what you're going to have to do to report it. They are going to have to report it back to the banks. Now, there are a number of fintech companies that are kind of stepping up to the plate and creating, you know, some quick and dirty PPP forgiveness solutions and systems that the banks can put in place to help the small businesses track stuff, because it's more than just the payroll. You know, there are other allowable expenses. And in the end, here's the other complicating factor is, you know, after you submit all this information back to the bank communicates, calculates all this stuff, you know, you might have taken out a $25,000 loan. Reality is that you may get $20,000 of it as forgiveness and $5,000 stays on the books with the banks. And as you mentioned, it does convert into a 1% two-year loan. And so what's funny is I've heard from a lot of small business owners who said, to be honest with you, we're doing kind of fine, but I saw this as a way to get money that I was going to be borrowing anyway. So, hey, 1% over 2 years, even I don't care if I get the forgiveness or not. And so a lot, you know, this is going to be a nightmare in terms of those who are really using it for payroll and paycheck protection. It's going to be a nightmare in terms of calculating it. There's also going to be tax implications where Congress had specified that this money would not be considered income. But there are tax experts who say, no, sorry, not so clear. There are other tax codes in the IRS sections that say, no, this stuff will be taxed. So we're looking at a nightmare, guys.
Well, and that, again, those organizations that are digital and did most of this digitally are going to be in a better position to be able to process the follow-up on this. I mean, if you're doing it the way you used to do small business loans, and that's a lot of the community banks, because that's where their strong suit was doing a whole lot of small business loans. If they're doing it the way they were doing old small business loans, you may have looked okay in the front end. You're going to look terrible on the back end. You know, it's going to be messy. It's going to make everybody angry. And what happens when the bank kicks it back to the bank and says, oh, by the way, not enough?
Yeah, not just digital, Jim, but those that captured a lot of the information and captured the right documentation. You know, they looked at this as quick and easy, you know, just get the minimum amount of data that they needed to get from the small businesses, and that's going to turn out to be insufficient, and then it's going to be tough. And then you get the case that, you know, historically the SBA has always tried to nickel and dime and get out of paying back their portion of what needs to be covered. Now, I think the political pressures will be on them to, you know, be a lot different this time around, but too many question marks in this forgiveness process.
Well, Ron, I'm happy to report that I'm probably responsible for at least 20 of your 300 and some thousand hits, because we've been sharing that article with the banks that we work with. And we think that it's absolutely something the banks ought to be paying very close attention to. We do quite a bit of work with Crow, and they've been looking into this. And exactly as you said, and you cited some of the other experts in your article, there's still a lot of fuzziness around this. There's still probably new rules that are going to come out after the fact, that, you know, looking for data that the banks didn't capture. And the other thing we didn't talk about early on was that there were so many of the smaller banks that just threw bodies at solving this, right? They, and to their credit, I love the can-do attitude and the commitment to their customers, but they didn't have a real process, right, with gathering all of the documentation and process. And we're going to head to break here in just 1 minute, but I'll also just add, you know, one can of worms that we purposely did not open today is the whole notion, if this idea is about protecting income of workers, why was the process your boss ought to go to the bank and apply for a loan, and then we may be able to forgive some of that for you. So we'll be back with more Breaking Banks right after this. We've talked quite a bit about how important it is to have a VPN, a virtual private network, to make private, secure connections over the internet. And now that a lot of you are working from home, it's even more important to choose a VPN you can trust. We love ExpressVPN, and here's why. Number one, ExpressVPN doesn't log your data. Lots of really cheap or free VPNs actually make money by selling your data to ad companies. I don't know about you, but I've had enough of my data being sold to ad companies, and ExpressVPN has developed a technology called Trusted Server that makes it impossible for their servers to log any of your information. Number two, speed. You've probably tried other VPNs like I have, and some of them are really slow. Sometimes they're so slow that you're actually considering turning it off or just logging off the internet completely, and that defeats the whole purpose of having a VPN in the first place, so that you can use the internet safely and securely. With ExpressVPN, your internet speeds are always super fast. Even when you're connected to servers thousands of miles away, you can still stream HD quality videos with zero lag. Something else that really sets ExpressVPN apart from other VPNs is how easy it is to use. With ExpressVPN, you don't have to input or program anything. You just fire up the app and click one button to connect. It's so easy, even your grandparents could use it. But don't take it from me. Wired, CNET, The Verge, and a slew of other tech journals rate ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So protect yourself with the VPN that you can trust. Use our special link at expressvpn.com/fintech today and get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/fintech. Visit expressvpn.com/fintech to learn more and get started today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Jack Henry is a great supporter of Breaking Banks. Jack Henry Digital is the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live local personal service meaningfully into digital channels. Jack Henry Digital also helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those of the mega banks and the big tech and fintechs. How do they do it? Well, it's with their Banno digital platform, a complete 100% API-enabled open digital banking platform. You get lightning-fast native apps, integrated PFM. You get cloud-based core-connected back-office tools for employees. And with the website marketing and content management capabilities built into their community, you can launch, track, and target campaigns quickly from click-through to product acquisition. Don't forget to also check out Banno Conversations, a first-of-its-kind, fully authenticated, secure chat capability that enables branch staff to connect digitally with customers. You want to check it out? You really have to see this in action. Visit banno.com to schedule a demo today. That's banno.com.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast and radio show. I'm JP Nichols, and we're talking about winners and losers in this pandemic era and the post-pandemic world. And I'd like to turn our focus a little bit further out now. Once the virus is under control and businesses are fully open, what does the new normal look like? And I want to talk about that from a perspective of both the banks and the broader financial services industry in fintech.
Yeah, JP, before we go on, I want to get back to what happened before the break. We were talking about the banks, what they're going to be doing in this post-PPP loan when you have to declare whether or not it can be forgiven. We have to remember as financial institutions, these organizations that all came in a 3-day period to get these loans are all going to be coming in a 3-day period to get forgiveness. And that process is a lot more lengthy than the process of taking loans. I think we have to think as financial institutions, can I collect the data now that I'll need later to be able to help our customers get these loans forgiven? There's no reason why we have to wait. The organizations that we gave these loans to already are collecting that data on how they're doing it. And it's a good service for the financial institution to be able to tell the small business, by the way, if you haven't done so, you better make sure you have some payroll receipts for what you said you're going to do, because I'm going to need those to make it so I can process through the government as quickly as possible. So just a word of warning, this gap between the period of taking the loan and forgiving the loan is time we need to take to collect the data we need to be able to process that on the back end just as efficiently as we did on the front end.
I couldn't agree more. And I think this is a time we talk about winners and losers, and, you know, maybe consultants and accountants are the big winners in all of this because there's so much complexity and uncertainty. I really think this is a time for most institutions to not go it alone and to really understand how do we get the best thinking around this and be able to build a system and one that's adaptable, because the rules are changing as we go along. Well, Penny, you know, you've reported for a long time on the ongoing consolidation in the industry. This certainly doesn't help, right? This is going to be more fuel to fire. So as we look out, you know, beyond just getting through the crisis on the other side of it, what do banks need to do to be able to survive?
That's a really interesting question. I think Jim was talking before about the need to really have a strong digital properties and a strong digital presence. And I think that is for sure a big part of what they are going to need to do. You know, I think the pandemic has only made mobile banking more important and the ability to make loans quickly online important, as we've been talking about. They probably need to continue some of their work from home efforts that they all had to quickly enable all their employees to work from home, like Jim was saying, call center people, as well as traders and lenders, and people working in branches and offices. They're going to have to go through that whole, you know, what does social distancing look like in the future, the way all companies do. And I think, as we've been saying, that the digital capabilities will need to continue to be strong. And I think they're going to have some interesting technology decisions to make, both about, you know, what they offer on their apps and online to be appealing, you know, especially to a younger generation, because banks aren't really attracting Gen Z, especially like the mid-size banks are not attracting the youngest customers at the same rate that the very largest banks are, and all banks have work to do in that area. But also with things like cloud computing, they're going to have to think hard about what they put on the cloud and how they secure that information. So also issues around cybersecurity and data privacy continue to escalate. So, you know, while they need to modernize, you know, there's something that we've talked about a lot here and elsewhere, that so many banks have outdated technology. They really do need to modernize in order to offer cutting edge capabilities. But it is very tricky to go to a modern cloud based core. And as you know, recent data breaches have shown, there are risks to it. So there are just sort of some interesting dilemmas that a lot of banks face on the technology side. And, you know, on the business side, they're going to have to really make tough decisions as the whole economy continues to struggle. Yeah, I actually was kind of impressed at a few of the banks like Bank of America that said we will have no layoffs in 2020. There weren't too many that committed to that. But the ones that did, I thought was good, because that certainly gives their employees a level of comfort and it reduces their stress a little bit. And also it kind of set a tone for the industry. And I think it was kind of a remarkable commitment, because they have hundreds of thousands of employees and very, very large payroll costs. So they're going to have to figure out, you know, as loans continue to, you know, not perform the way that they would like to, and margins continue to be small, they're going to have to figure out where they do make cost cuts and where they do that without, you know, putting themselves at risk.
You bring up a couple of interesting points. I want to start by going back just a little bit, and you talked about the dilemmas that banks have to balance on, right? There's risk to moving to new technology and there's costs involved. And for the past decade, the industry has been able to pretty easily justify that those risks didn't offset the upside that they were getting, because they were already doing well enough, right? The industry was at record profits. And Jim, you talked about the doctor visit scare. Jason Henricks has been talking about that a lot. He calls it that heart attack moment. We all know we need to eat more and move less, but sometimes it takes a really serious health scare to get us to actually do something dramatic about it. And so I do wonder if that's going to continue. But then you also bring up some interesting thoughts just in the more macro basis around, you know, do the banks need to go on a diet? Do they need to change what they're eating and consume a diet of healthy technology, but also just reduce some of that overhead? Ron, what are you thinking the banks need to do from an operating expense perspective?
Yeah, you know, I think Penny listed a lot of things that would be very helpful to that. And one of the things that Penny brought up was, you know, making difficult decisions. And I think one of the things that fits under that category is really rationalizing the cost structure of the banks. You know, Brett, of course, talks all the time about, you know, the death of branches, and everybody likes to argue, no, they still have a role, blah, 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 blah. And maybe they do. But look, the reality is, hey, maybe we just can't afford it anymore. And especially now with the change in a lot of consumers' behaviors, see a spike in mobile adoption, of course. And I'm sure that there's plenty of customers who can't wait to get back into the branch because they hate doing this stuff. But you know what? I hate pumping my own gas too. But 40 years ago, they forced us to do it, and it has never come back, you know, except for a few gas stations.
And if you could move to New Jersey or Oregon, right?
Oregon. Oh, yeah. Two states, you know, the holdouts. But in banking, let's get real. You know, especially now that the bank's profits have been hit so incredibly hard in Q1, we're not going to probably see that V-shaped recovery. And so where's that diet going to come from? It's going to have to come from, well, like it or not, it's probably going to have to come from staffing to somewhat, because that's an immediate, you know, expense that they can.
Well, and overhead, overall, the branches, you know, I talked to Richard Hunt on a podcast interview for Banking Transformed, and he said, you know, for the first time, he really thinks there's going to be movement on CRA. He said the Community Reinvestment Act is being looked at and saying, what was the concept to begin with? It was making sure you kept investing in the lower income neighborhoods. Well, the branches is not the way to keep that investment going. He says, but the problem has been, we've never had a tangible way of saying what's going to qualify as being able to close a branch and reinvest money someplace else. And he says, we're very close to bringing a tangible answer to that. So number one, close those branches that are completely ineffective and are only there because the government regulations say we'll make it very difficult on you if you close them, when there's really a better alternative, which is reinvesting in that area outside of a branch. And next, you know, as you said, human resources, we now are in an era where the digital transformation is simply being held up by legacy thinking. And so we have to say, you know, somebody wrote to me this week and said, what do you think the outcome is going to be on the universal banker concept? I said, if you as a banker are thinking about anything with regard to how to make a better experience in the branch, I'm telling you right now, for the rest of this year, deploy all those dollars and resources and mind thought into what can I do digitally better? Because if you're putting any money into the branch network right now, that is poor allocation of funds, in my opinion, as opposed to putting it towards a better digital experience. Because you know one's not going to go away. The other one may not. But how good is it to get a better rating on some kind of survey if one half of the people that were prior to COVID going to the branch, which was already 6 times lower than it was 10 years ago, you know, what difference does it make? At the end of the day, what difference does it make if you have a great greeter in the front of the branch if nobody's showing up there? And I'd say anything you had put towards, except for closing branches, towards the budget of branch right now for the rest of the year, put towards some aspect of digital engagement, because that money's going to pay off and the other one may not.
Yeah, I totally agree, Jim. And I'm glad you made the distinction between the branch experience and the branch itself, because reality is, you know, they're not going to break leases. They may own the real estate. It's not as easy as just shutting the doors and walking away. But you've got to be crazy to be putting money into new ITMs, sorry for all the vendors who are going to kill me on this one, you know, for inside the branches themselves. You know, it's because who's going to want to be in those little rooms, you know, after somebody's been in there? You know, even we get into the question of, like, post-crisis, well, when is post-crisis? How long does this, you know, really last, you know, that we're going to be comfortable going into these things? So,
you know, invest in a Zoom platform so you can bring multiple calling officers on a screen to talk to a business customer instead of putting a teller on a screen that's going to be in a screen in a branch, which doesn't take care of the problem, you know.
Jim, here's what drives me nuts. It's going to be a whole lot simpler than that. How about just giving your customers a list of the employees that they should call if they have this particular question about this particular thing, and they force them to call the contact center, which is getting overloaded today, and as you mentioned earlier, is going to get way overloaded when the PPP loans start coming up for forgiveness. You have to authenticate yourself before you get in, and so it makes it impossible to actually talk to somebody, and then when you do, they don't know anything. The reason we have branches in the first place is so that people can meet people. But we are doing it right now through Zoom, so why can't banks be doing it? They're learning that they can do this. There are some simple steps that they can take to help redirect that traffic out of the branches. And I think one thing they're going to have to really do to look at the costs. JP?
One of the things that we've been looking at is what kinds of technologies will banks be likely to invest in, or should they invest in? And one of the things is scheduling. So maybe when you do have that need for the branch, you actually have a schedule and you get to the right person. So maybe that's just slightly more sophisticated than what you suggested, Ron, which is here's a list of who to call. And I was really happy to hear one of our bank CIOs say, you know, we were looking at that and we started to think about what's the reason behind the reason. So rather than just give everybody a better way to make an appointment in the branch, we want to understand, well, what are you coming in for? And if we can solve that in something that doesn't involve a branch visit, then that's probably a better solution. And initially that was short term because we were trying to limit person-to-person contact, but they're really becoming believers in that and thinking about that's probably a longer term solution too, right? If we can solve the problem and we can do so in a way that's cheap and efficient and everybody's happy, why should we force it to something that's manual and face-to-face?
Well, yeah. And we can't assume that the consumer knows what's available. I think what we saw, and I've heard this from more than a couple of people that work in the auto teller lines of branches, they said our auto teller lines are an hour long, and then we put somebody out there to greet the consumer and say, by the way, this transaction, let me show you how this can be done without you having to stand in line. And did an auto deposit, you know, a remote deposit capture, or they found a way to do it another way. And the consumer's so used to coming to the branch. So they transferred an in-branch visit to an out-of-branch visit when there's only a single teller line outside. And all of a sudden, when they had a greeter, and we've seen this a couple places, that said, by the way, we have a better alternative. And sometimes it may just be engaging by phone or some other way. We need to think about the fact that don't resolve the problem by saying, see, people still want to come to the branch, when you really haven't dug to the next layer to say, and what for? And are they better served in another way? Again, it's a scheduling, it's an allocation of resources and determining what's the consumer really looking for as opposed to what are they doing? They're vastly different.
I'm seeing a little mini trend toward these apps that let you choose a banker, like your own personal banker. Like Umpqua was the first one. They have this go-to banker, and there's this little directory of their customer-facing employees, and you know whether or not they like cats and their hobbies and where they live and all that kind of. You get this little bios and little human interest vignettes on each one.
It's like freshman orientation.
Well, yeah, and I've actually talked with them a couple times about like, does this become personality contest, like a popularity contest? And that actually is something that they've worried about. And what they do is they sort of shuffle the deck each time so that people are seeing different people first. So they have ways of kind of getting around it. But the point is kind of to what Jim was saying, it gives people a way to, and Ron was saying this too, connect to one person that they get to know that they can text or call with whatever they need. We are seeing an uptick in use of video contact, like Jim was talking about Zoom, but there are companies that specifically do that for banks. And I actually see the ITM or the video teller machine as having some potential. A lot of the banks that have that are seeing increased use of those in this day and age, because that way they can go, you know, to a kiosk that might be right outside a branch, or it might be outside a store or somewhere else, and they can, you know, not only do basic transactions, but ask more complicated questions and even submit loan documents and while someone's watching, you know, over the video. So I feel like there's some potential for that to do better. And then, of course, I think we've all written about the virtual assistants, and that could also be something that becomes more popular as everyone becomes more digital.
We finally found a job for Pepper the robot.
Yeah, that's right.
The Pepper does not have to socially distance, so he can come up and give you your paper deposit slip and the signature card and the pen to sign it with. Well, speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about deposits. You know, the classic race, as we talk about disruption and innovation in financial services, is can the incumbents innovate faster than the new entrants can scale up? And so I want to, before we close, I want to talk about deposits in general. I want to talk about who's been the winners and losers there and what's that look like going forward, because about $8 trillion has flowed into the financial services industry. Where did it come from? Where did it go? And then before we close, let's close on fintech and talk about that. So who wants to weigh in on that one?
I'll be quick. I promise you I'll be quick. I think we have to look at deposits in a new light. I've been an advocate of Robinhood and Acorns, the ones that use AI to determine when I have funds available for deposit and for savings. That is the way we have to move forward, not by waiting for a customer to come in and deposit funds, or not by setting a specific amount and having that go in monthly. We've got to combine data AI and deposit type services or investment type services into a single product that flows in and out of checking accounts as needed, into online banking or overdraft protection as needed. Ron?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, JP. It really kind of works both sides. And Jim, by the way, you were quick. Thank you. I wasn't ready because I thought you were going to take an awfully lot longer time, so I wasn't ready to kind of jump in.
You've been on the show with Jim before.
Yeah, I have been. And it's a good thing we're actually not doing video here for reasons that the four of us now know. Here's the thing. First of all, a lot of the money that flowed in to deposits in the past, 6 to 8 weeks did so because a lot of people were cashing out of the stock market and out of their investment holdings. And not surprisingly, a lot of that went to the big banks where they're doing business. So, the big banks saw a lot of that. A lot of the fight with deposits, the debate has been around, can you do it online or do you need the branches? And, interestingly, there's cases to be made on both sides of the coin. In the 5 or so quarters from the beginning of 2019 through the Q1 of 2020, J.P. Morgan Chase had opened up a bunch of branches in the Northeast, up the East Coast. And according to their filings, 6 branches brought in about $500 million, across those 6 branches. So it proved, to some portion of the market that, hey, there's life in branches from around deposit gathering. On the other hand, you look at Marcus's growth in deposits, and they've now cleared $70 billion in deposits without ever having opened a single branch. So, the argument about you have to do digital, you have to do branches, both are good at doing that. But I think we're getting to the point now where, because of the shift in the economy, the focus is going to be a lot more on what do we do with those deposits, not gathering them, because a lot of those opportunities are, up in the air. The creditworthiness of a lot of the business borrowers is hurting. So I think we're going to start to see the perennial shift in the deposit gathering focus.
Well, and let's think about deposits from the other side of it. We think about it so much from the customer's perspective, which is a great place to start. But for the banks, it's the lifeblood, right? Having a low-cost source of funds that you can mark up and lend out is exactly what the banking business is at its core. The Robin Hoods and the Chimes of the world, it's something a little different. They're typically, in most cases, not holding those deposits, which are a liability, by the way. It screws up everybody used to accounting 101. It's not an asset. That's a deposit from a financial institution's perspective. And so then the question for the fintechs, and this I think will lead us into our fintech discussion before we close today, is then the trick was, well, how do we monetize that? And so is that, better access? Is it, adding benefits or bells and whistles on top of that, or the financial planning and so on? So, and we'll do lightning round here before we close. And Ron, you have the floor last. I'll give it to you next. What's your prediction for what does fintech look like 12 months from now?
Okay, I'll try to be really quick here to appease Jim so I don't get any more trouble with him. Look, we got to really look at fintech not from this, single umbrella term, but at the least split it between the B2C focused and the B2B focused. Those fintechs that, see the financial institutions as their customers and partners, and those that go directly to consumers. On the B2C, I may be wrong, but I'm going to tell you, I'm bearish. I'm not that bullish on their prospects in the next 12 months. You got Betterment looking to get into banking. You had Robinhood trying to get into banking. And you have to do that over a certain period of time because you hit limits in your growth. This is a bad time to try to be growing on the retail side. On the other side, though, I think those that are focused more on a B2B strategy have a lot more legs, and I think are going to really emerge as vendors. And not just the fintech, but the big tech. I think you're going to see Amazon and Google emerge as real fintech vendors, not as bank or competitors to banks, but as vendors.
Penny, what do you think?
Well, I'm a little more bullish on the challenger banks. I think they have seen like Chime and Varo Money especially got up to 7 million users, and they're growing very quickly. They're kind of accelerating in their growth, and I think they are getting a reputational boost from, as you mentioned before, some of the efforts that they're making to get stimulus advances to people. And they do have a, I think, a better overall perception from consumers. I think that these challengers, it takes them a while to gain awareness and to get traction, but then once they do really well. I think JP brought up a really good point about profitability, because they do make a lot of their money off of interchange fees, and that's not the most profitable model. I think a lot of them do want to get into lending, and we're going to see more of them offer lines of credit and small loans. I think the alternative online lenders have been struggling, and I think it'll be interesting to watch how they do. LendingClub had a really difficult quarter, and it's going to be challenging for some of the online lenders that do have customers on the lower end of the spectrum that don't have the highest of credit scores. I think that's going to be a challenge for them. But, you know, and fintechs that serve businesses, again, they're going to be affected by the economy like everybody else. Those that are small business focused, I think we'll probably see a thinning out as small businesses continue to struggle. But then obviously we'll see some that do make it and do well. You know, we saw Cabbage have a tough time for a while, but they've now picked up again. So, but overall, I'm pretty bullish on the fintech market, although there will be some losses.
All right. And Jim, against Ron's better judgment, you have the final word today.
Okay, I'll make it quick. I think we're going to see a mirror image between what's happening in the banking industry, what's happening in the fintech industry. What I mean by that is the bigger organizations are going to do well in recognition. They have a business model that's not going to completely depend on VC funding. The small organizations that are the most focused and have the most segmentation on who they're trying to meet, both in the banking world and the fintech world, are going to do okay. These mid-sized organizations in the banking world and the fintech world that really are jockey between, geez, do they have a real differentiation? Do they have a real customer base? And are they relying on the right sources of income or funding, are going to fail, or they're going to be absorbed, or they're going to need investors. I believe the middle market in both entities shrinks tremendously as long as there's buyers out there, which is, you know, how much money is anybody going to have to fund anything? But I think overall, we're going to see a scaling back and a thinning out in both entities, both the banking industry and the fintech industry, where we're already seeing it. The bigger ones are still getting funding, but you don't hear anyone else getting the funding. Overall in fintech is going way down. I think the same is going to happen in the banking industry. The smallest community banks that are really responding to the community needs are going to do well. The regionals and the mid-sized banks are going to struggle tremendously because they're caught in the crosshairs. They don't have enough money to fund digital investments. On the other hand, they don't have a real differentiation.
It's hard to win. It's hard to win from the middle.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, if you like the show, give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, the Finovate podcast, and more, all on provoke.fm. That's it for this week. We'll see you again next week for more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.